welcome everyone joining us here tonight on the King County Radio Club Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. Also, we offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website. The link can be found on the front page of our website in orange color type, but if you would like a simple URL to find it, just type in puzzle.kc2rc.com. Also, we will be offering a streaming service to those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. This set is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesday of each month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is always available on our website. No question is too simple, no question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this technical net. Please give us your name, your call sign, and whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment and, when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here or use our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. So we begin the technical net tonight. Jason, WF2N, is away in an Aries meeting and will not be able to join us today, but he'll be back next time. So if anyone has any questions or comments for the technical net at this time, please hit that push-to-talk button. Give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, very well. We will try this again. In the great words of one of our great net control operators, this seems like it might be one of our shorter nets tonight, but we'll see. Once again, if anyone is out there and anyone has any questions or comments for the technical net tonight, feel free to hit that push-to-talk button and give me your first name and call sign.
KC2, WTA, Joe.
Joe recognized. Good evening, Joe. Let me ask if anyone else wants to be put down on the list for any topics or questions for the technical question and answer net today, tonight. Okay, very well. Joe, you're on the top of the list. You're the only one on the list. Any questions or comments tonight, Joe?
No real question, Roy, just because you had no response there. But I was looking more into 3D printing and looking at programs that can translate technical drawings into programs that a 3D printer can use. Back to you.
Found anything interesting? They probably fall into two categories. One are the category of software that takes images, and you probably have to rotate the image 360 degrees and take multiple views of it, and then merge it together, and the program tries to make some kind of a three-dimensional mesh sense of the object. The other is probably more of a CAD/CAM type of a software in which you have to really give it the dimensions and it'll help you build three-dimensional objects. So what exactly have you been looking for and what have you found?
Yeah, well, I found the photographic type, and you need to take at least 200 photographs of it and load that into a program, the name of which I of course forget already, but as you say, it would merge it into a format that a 3D printer could understand. But I was also looking for computer-aided drafting programs that could be interface with 3D print. I didn't find it, I only did. I was actually trained as a mechanical draftsman. My father trained me, and I used it extensively in the museum. And we never had a computer-aided drafting system out there. I was just wondering if I could find something like that. And then, Lord, by way of a question, there are places now that they're like salons with banks and banks of 3D printers. And I understand you can take a program to this place, to these places, and they'll build it out for you, or print it, or build it up for you. Is that right? KC2WTA.
Yes, Joe. There are a lot of places because 3D printers are almost ubiquitous, and you give them the design parameters, the file that you would put into your printer, and they can print it out. You can choose different types of materials depending upon what they have available, colors and a PLA versus ABS versus nylon versus a few other forms of less esoteric plastic. And if you go to a more high end, they might be able to tweak the model design. But the problem with these photographic assembly programs is that you usually have to clean them up after the fact. They either generate far too many triangles. The meshes are too detailed and would probably clog up most software, so you have to kind of start to cut them down to the lowest common denominator. Also, sometimes they just leave openings and holes where they can't quite figure out what's going on. In addition, although you tell me that you haven't really used anything like AutoCAD, Autodesk, that makes AutoCAD, also makes, I think it's called Fusion 360. It's the kind of deluxe version of 3D CAD CAM that's used by a lot of people who prototype 3D stuff for 3D printers. And you can probably get to use it for at least a couple of years for free. The ticket for it, if you buy it, is atrociously high. But it's very easy to just tell them that you're using it for educational purposes, and they'll let you use it for a while without paying anything.
Yeah, it's something I'm going to continue to look into. You know, aside from collecting Lionel trains and stuff, I collect a lot of toys of the 1960s, and of course there's always something missing. And there are a lot of little things that could be made in a 3D printer that are just so scarce. And when they do appear on eBay, they're just ridiculous. You know, there's always a bidding war going on for it. Sometimes for the smallest item, you know, the final can really roll up there. So, yeah, this is definitely something to look into in the future. KC2WTA.
KC2JS. No, I agree with you entirely, Joe. For the fabrication of small plastic parts, it's very useful. It depends upon your ability to kind of climb up the learning curve of some of these CAD/CAM pieces of software. There's things like MeshRider, and there's about three or four others out there that are much simpler and have a cleaner graphic user interface. They're not as flexible and powerful as Fusion 360, but they might suit you as well. It's just you got to get the measurements down, and you got to get a sense of how the software works. But otherwise, there's thousands and thousands of files out there, and if you're very lucky, someone had the same idea as you and went to the trouble of building a file and then sharing it with the rest of the people. I found all kinds of fascinating little designs for things on the web. So think about it, consider it. The price point for 3D printers kind of starts really low. You know, they're not the most powerful flexible, but they start at something like $250 out of China.
Yeah, it would be fun to play with, but I think my use of it would be so limited, I don't think it would pay for me. And that's why I would check out one of these outfits that will print for you. But it's all very interesting. I'll tell you, one thing that really disturbs me, though, is these people printing the guns on these things. I was a shooter. I shot for 25 years. I gave up shooting to go into amateur radio. And my rifle is up on the wall now on a pair of pegs. And it just really wigs me out to think that somebody can print out an operating firearm. KC2WTA.
KC2GS. Yeah, I'm aware of that, Joe. The only thing I could say is they're terrible guns, if you've ever kind of looked at them. And they're pretty much guaranteed, if anyone uses them probably more than once, the chances are very good that it will go off right on them. ABS and PLA plastic is not a great type of material to use for exploding bullets. And the pin that triggers it apparently is either a screw or a nail that you include in the design. So these guys are kind of self-limited. You know, after a little while, they kind of blow their hands off anyway.
Yeah, I would imagine that the 3D printed gun could fail on the first discharge, or certainly after a few. Years ago, people used to make zip guns. They'd get a telescopic antenna, and they'd find a section of that antenna that fit whatever ammunition they had, usually a .22 caliber, and they'd make up a gun, and it would blow up in their hand because the section of antenna couldn't contain the, couldn't take the pressure spike. We may be hearing about that in the future, along with drones being sucked into the intake of jet engines. I think we'll hear about people 3D printing guns and having them explode in their hand. KC2WTA.
KC2GS. Well, thankfully, they have had these designs for guns out for at least a year, maybe two. And I haven't heard of a single case of anyone using it anywhere at any time. What upsets a lot of people is just the availability of these things and the possibility of what they might wreak. But ultimately, push comes to shove. Either people have been wise or cowardly and haven't tried, or it hasn't been reported. If people were really regularly using these little plastic things as guns, I think that there would be more than enough reports of people blowing off their hands. So I think it's one of those things that excites the press more than anyone else, including people who like to use guns. And my guess is most people who like to use guns know better ways of getting much safer guns to be got.
That certainly makes sense. Quarter after nine. Roy, do you want to check for more check-ins?
Yes, indeed, Joe. This is AC2GS Roy here with the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesday of every month at 9 p.m., and we're here tonight. So if you have any questions of a technical nature, or any comments or statements, or like to review any topic, hit that push-to-talk button, give me your first name and your call sign. Gosh, it looks like it's going to be one of those nights, Joe.
Yeah, it looks that way, Roy. That's why I thought I'd better jump in. And, maybe we could just, if only to justify your time. And, I don't know what you want to talk about. I have so many irons in the fire right now. You know, I'm trying to get the new operating position finished. I've done the work on the RF ground on the interior, and the weather's been such that I just can't get the outside and continue out and get out to the ground rods and the bus bar and whatnot. And I got a bunch of other stuff I'm doing. I contracted work on the house. Next week I'm having some windows replaced, and I got some medical things to take care of, and they need to have a prostate biopsy and a colonoscopy, and trying to coordinate all this stuff. But I also want to get back to helicopter radios and start the diagramming that I wanted to do. I got a lot of stuff to do. KC2WTA.
Hey Joe, it's probably best that you have a lot of stuff rather than no stuff, because you have more options for you. And setting up an HF station usually can be loads of fun. I understand. You know, the weather, it's been surprisingly wet for the last, I don't know, I've lost count. It's not like 3 weeks. It's just kind of like every other day has either been cloudy, rainy, or you know, something terrible. I don't think we've had two or three days of straight sunshine in a row in the past month. I usually leave that to our noted amateur weatherman, Howie, KD2MSU. I noticed this problematic trend in the weather, so I can understand why you are having problems finding a good time to go out there and deal with the grounding rods and such. But I'm sure you'll find the time and get everything set up and have loads of fun on HF. HF, 20 meters is tolerable at certain times of the day, but, you know, 40 and 80 are probably the best places to hang out on HF until the sunspot cycles improve a bit.
Yeah, I'm on HF now. I check into the Sunday net using TS 430 Kenwood, and the new high frequency station is going to be all Heath kit, and I really don't know the operational status of a lot of the equipment. A few of the receivers, yes, but the transmitters and the amplifiers, no. But if I don't get that RF ground going soon, I think I'm gonna pull a transmitter out to the kitchen table and start working on it. You know, this rainy bit is gonna continue, because this station is gonna be beautiful. Nothing in the station after 1970. So it's gonna be a real vintage Heathkit high frequency station. It's probably just what a museum professional would have, a real piece of history. KC2WTA.
KC2GS, very good, Joe. It sounds like it's going to be loads of fun. And all you really need is a dummy load, and you can test out your transmitter and get a good sense for whether it's going to work out of the box or whether it's going to need a little bit of a tuning up phase.
The separate receivers and separate transmitters have their power supplies built in, and the transceivers need an external power supply. So, trying to decide whether or not I'd use the transceiver with an outboard VFO for, split work, or use the receiver transceiver. It takes up more room on the table. I don't know which one I could get going faster, but I'll have to see. But I'm getting so itchy to get a Heathkit transceiver going that I might start on the transceiver before I finish the RF ground. KC2WTA.
Okay, sounds like you're in store for lots of fun. Sometimes just getting these things running well is a very rewarding experience that a lot of amateur radio operators get. So have fun with it, and it's not only is it functional, but it's historic. When I was a little kid, I always wanted a Collins receiver transmitter pair. Some little kids would count sheep when they fell asleep. I seem to remember tuning up the final amplifier on a Collins transmitter as I was trying to get to sleep. But I never got it. One of the many reasons is I just don't have the room. Those things take up a lot of space.
Yeah, it takes up the corner of a room. I have here the Kenwood TS-430, the power supply, and the outboard speaker. And those three items together are the one Heathkit either receiver or transmitter. It's about as big as this. So, yeah, they take up a lot of room. And the Collins is about three times the value of Heathkit. And the Heathkit SB series were modeled after Collins. And I just gravitated towards this because in the 1970s, I went on a high school trip to the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia, and the Institute had an all-Collins station, and man, was it beautiful. It was just something to look at, and my setup here looks very much like it. It's not functioning yet, but it looks a lot like the Franklin Institute's amateur radio station.
Very good. Well, the Collins equipment was kind of the Rolls Royce of radio gear. You know, you made it when that was what was sitting on your desk. And although they cost a fraction of what the high-end radios cost these days with inflation and such, they were very attractive. The Collins had a wonderful style that was mimicked by Heathkit. I used to get the Heathkit catalogs every time they came out and dream of great things, and unfortunately I barely had a couple of quarters to rub together, so you couldn't really buy much from Heathkit for a couple of quarters. But I remember one time when I was deeply confused when they were trying to sell a colored television set kit, and you know, it made sense to me to put together test gear, and it made sense to me to put together amateur radio gear. For some odd reason, I guess I just had a cognitive speed bump when it came to putting together a color television set, plus the fact that it highlighted the reality that a kit for something isn't less expensive than an assembled version because of all the trouble they had to take with instructions and idiot-proofing these things so you didn't destroy what you bought. So that was one of the last great things that I saw that I remembered in my Heathkit catalog was they had some like two or three different models of color television sets. I'm sure you got all of those catalogs back in the day.
Yeah, I got them every year, like right up until like 92 or something like that, when the company went down. The last few catalogs were really depressing. It was very sad to see. But I had a neighbor put together a Heathkit color console. And it was a pretty nice television. And you had to like building. You know, it was really, you certainly weren't saving any money. You could buy a very nice console color television for just about the same price.
I think it was primarily people who like to build kits. They got the opportunity to build a kit, and another rationalization was if anything went wrong with the kit, they had assembled it, so they had a better understanding of what was broken, and they could fix it themselves without a TV repair person. But I don't know. I just kind of thought of it as very curious. I don't know if you've been following. They went bankrupt, obviously, and such, and they sold the name off to a series of people. And the last group came up with this really weird AM radio without a volume or a speaker. You have to plug a headphone in with a gain control. And, you know, it just looked awful. It didn't look good. It didn't work terribly well. Specs weren't great, and yet they charged $100 or plus dollars. And they were going to come up with a power meter, you know, one of these digital display standing wave ratio and watts and other values, and it looked so ticky-tack. It was a prototype that they looked like they had glued together. So it was a mess. Thankfully, I haven't heard anything lately from them because, you know, talk about a shadow of their former selves.
Yeah, I saw that. That was a real tease for me, and I got a real laugh out of that. That was a radio, a no soldering radio. That was in, looked like screw terminals holding everything together. But yeah, I loved building. I built a lot of kits. In fact, I built a Heath kit New Year's Eve, 1999. I was very leery about going out. The turn of the millennium, I really felt that something was going to happen if you were someplace, you know, some nut was going to do something. So I stayed home, and I built, I won on eBay a Heath Kit code practice oscillator. And I sat here, had a few drinks, and built this code practice oscillator. And I declared it the last Heath kit assembled in the 20th century.
C2JS. Well, congratulations to you. I remember, I think it was Radio Shack sold code oscillator kits at a time. I bought a Morse code key, and I bought the oscillator kit, and I soldered it together, and I screwed it. I put the oscillator kit together with a speaker and one of my old father's old cigar box, and then I put that on a plank of wood with a Morse code key, and that was my practice key that I kept on trying to learn Morse code with. That was back in either the late 60s or the early 70s. I don't think I've really put together that many kits since then. I've assembled computers and things, but that's not quite the same thing. I've fixed things. I've taken apart laptops and had to solder components back onto them, but nothing that would qualify as a kit. You know, that was a fun time back way back when. But and there are people who still love kits. There's a whole minor industry. 73 Magazine has a guy who writes an article. He shows up every Xenia Hamfest, I think he has a special hat that people recognize him, and his big thing is kit building.
Yeah, I built a lot of kits, I built, I think, almost all of my diagnostic equipment. I put together an oscilloscope, an RF generator, AF generator, RCL bridge, signal tracer. I built a low voltage and a high voltage power supply, a 400 volt power supply for tube work, and all the amplifiers I built. I'm saying all. I think I built five amplifiers over the years, five tube amplifiers. So yeah, I've done a lot of this stuff. I don't know, Roy, do you want to check for another check-in?
Yes, indeed, Joe. Again, this is AC2GS Roy here, net control for the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Net, meeting here every second and fourth Wednesday in the month. And once again, if anyone has any questions or comments or statements or what have you for the Technical Net tonight, please hit that push-to-talk button. Give us your first name and your call sign. Okay, it is AC2GS. Unfortunately, it was about 95% noise, and I even have things set up so that I can listen on the input, but I couldn't make out in the input either. So you're probably on the other side of, from me, from the repeater. And so I can't hear you on the input. I can't really make you out on the output. If you can wiggle or wackle your antenna or boost the power and try again, feel free.
This is David, Kilo Delta 2, Mike Oscar Bravo, Fair Lawn, New Jersey, listening in on the conversation on the East Coast.
Good, Mike Oscar Bravo. Welcome to our little technical net. This is kind of just more conversational than anything else. And yes, talking to Joe, KC2WTA in Staten Island, and he's a big fan of the Heathkit machines. I lusted after Heathkits when I was young and had no money. And nowadays, I just have my stuff pre-assembled for me. I guess I've grown lazy in my old age.
My older brother was very involved in Heathkit speakers, as well as an AM/FM stereo that he built on his own. I was a young kid at the time, but quite amazing stuff.
Oh yeah, it was kind of fantastic, all the stuff I mentioned earlier. I was kind of confused and amazed by a company that was thought that they could build kits of color television sets, because that always struck me as the most intricate, complicated design there was. And it probably was a big a job for people who did that. But they had speakers, which were a lot easier, because for all intents and purposes, they were usually passive components. So you soldered together the treble and bass passive filters, and hooked it up to the loudspeaker assembly, screwed in the those to the wooden panel, and you were done. So probably speakers were generally the ones that didn't really require a great deal of effort, keeping straight what part components you had to solder, and putting them in the right little slots and such. But I used to love those catalogs. I dreamt of buying almost all of the things that were shown in that in those catalogs. You know, that was a great epic time for kit building. Nowadays, kits are interesting, but they tend to be rather low cost, much more simpler things these days.
This is a KD2MOB. Yes, matter of fact, I still have a pair of C2s with me. They're about 45 years old, but believe it or not, they still work. Amazingly enough, they still work.
Well, that's the beauty of speakers. They tend not to have things like electrolytic capacitors, so those are the things that go bad rather quickly. And as long as the design of the speaker doesn't have some kind of material that dries out or the glue fails, surprisingly, speakers can tolerate all kinds of travails and persist. So I still have a couple of speakers sitting in down in the basement that are functional. For whatever reason, I moved up to newer designs. But it's kind of difficult to beat the hell out of a loudspeaker unless you have either a dog or cat or something that kind of likes to chew things, or you have a little kid who likes to poke things with a screwdriver.
Yeah, I agree. They just last forever. I remember with my older brother having the schematics and figuring things out, and I just didn't get into it as much as he did, but he liked putting things together and taking things apart, or sometimes actually taking things apart and then putting things together.
Well, I think we all kind of started off as taking things apart. Some of us got good enough with it that they could put things back together. When I was a little kid, I took all kinds of things apart, and I kind of didn't know my limits in some ways. You know, most people who take things apart will stop at the components. You know, they'll get it down to a transistor for a capacitor and they'll consider it a success and move on to take apart other things. I used to smash up bits and pieces of things to see what was inside the capacitors and what was inside the IF loading tanks, and I even pulled the cap off of a 2-3 transistor trying to figure out how the heck those work.
It's amazing stuff. Sometimes with me, when I took things apart, they just never, it was not the thing. It was not the thing. Just didn't get it back together again. But it was all good back in the day. Very good. Just wanted to, hear more conversation on it. Because it takes me back to the early to mid-1970s.
Very good, David, and please, we're here, like I said before, every second and fourth Wednesday of the month. We talk about all kinds of different things, and we're open to turn the conversation to different topics of interest of whoever checks in, so please feel free to check in again if you're sitting in front of the radio one of these Wednesday nights.
I do appreciate it, and I'm glad to be coming in now. I turned the power higher on the Ken Wood and all of you. Thank you very much. 82MOB listening.
David, thank you very much. This is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra Roy with the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net, which meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m. If anyone has any questions or comments, feel free to hit push the talk button and give us your first name and your call sign. Okay, not sure who that was. That was about 99% noise and even dropout beyond that. And I, again, am gazing longingly at the input signal and not seeing much of an amplitude to grab onto. So I can't hear you on the input. I can't hear you on the output. If you could either raise the power that you're transmitting or adjust your antenna to a slightly different orientation, and hopefully we'll be able to pick you up better on the repeater. No, I'm sorry. I can't make you out, unfortunately. If you can kind of adjust the antenna or the power setting, we'll try again in a little while. Let me just ask again if anyone out there has any questions or answers or topics or statements or what have you for the technical net tonight. Okay, well, let's give this a try, especially with you there, Joe. We have a TechNet puzzle, as we always do. It's more of a visual one than an auditory one, but I'll try and describe it. Basically, there are two sine waves. One is a voltage potential. It starts at zero, at the zero point, goes to a peak, then drops down, crosses over, goes to a negative point, crosses over again. So it's a sine wave. The other one in dashed lettering that's noted as current is more of a cosine wave in that its maximum is at zero. At 90 degrees, it transitions to the zero base. At 180, it's down to a negative, and it goes up and down like a cosine does. Anyway, the question at hand is to ask what that curve is produced from that has a voltage and current that are 90 that are out of phase with each other. In that the current, when the voltage is low, the current is high. And as the voltage reaches maximum, the current dips and then reverses. So you can, of course, see the illustration on puzzles.kc2rc.com. But the question is this a graph of voltage and current potential through time of a capacitor, a resistor, an inductor, or a diode? So I will throw it out to the audience, which I guess is Joe.
okay, since the other stations are kind of far away. It looks to me like current is leading voltage, and since capacitors resist a change in voltage, I'm going to say this is the signature of a capacitor. That's answer A.
Quite right, Joe. It is a capacitor. If it had been a resistor, resistors don't affect the phase. The voltage follows the current identically. So the curve for a resistor would have both of the curves identically the same. Inductors would have it the other way around, and diodes would only have half of the conduction, either the positive or negative, depending upon how you oriented the diode. So as you said, the answer is capacitor. So that's good. It's always nice to remember basic concepts of how capacitors, inductors, and resistors work. It makes all of our tuned circuits that we would have a problem operating radio frequency without. So thanks, Joe, and again, this is AC2GS with surprisingly not probably the shortest, but one of the shorter episodes of the Technical Net. If anyone has any questions or comments at all, please let me know. Otherwise, I guess we'll just roll this up. Okay, very well. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We meet on the first Wednesday of each month. Our next meeting will be June 5th. We offer a pre-meeting technical question and answer session, much like this net, from 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. as time allows. Our regular general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues until anywhere from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m., depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday at 9 p.m. on this repeater, as well as a 10-meter net every Sunday at 11 a.m. on 28.380 megahertz upper sideband. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month at 9 p.m. We have a weekly net featuring Yaesu Fusion Digital Technology. That's every Thursday at 9 p.m. on our club website, on our club repeater, AC2RC. And a weekly swap and shop in digital fusion mode every Friday night at 9 p.m. If you can communicate using Fusion technology, please join in. We offer an audio stream of the Fusion Net on the Internet, as well as all audio transmissions of our club repeater at stream.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. As always, an application is available on our website. If you would like to contact the host of this technical net, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our club website and participate. Our website services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, 3 Alien Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks, but wisdom listens. So try to listen a bit more and talk about a bit less. Well, again, it's time to roll this all up and shut this all down, but we'll be back to do this all over again May 22nd, and everyone's welcome to join us again. Thanks to all the people that participated tonight. Without you guys, I'd just be talking to myself. So, this is Roy, AC2GS, going clear and getting the heck out of here. Until next time, guys, have a great week.
AC2GS, N2HUH.
Oh, Andrew, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing well. I just happen to be in the room here, and looking over some things. And what's new with you, and how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Just finished up the Kings County Radio Club's technical net here, and I'm going to archive the audio file and freshen up the website.
saw a device today. I'm not sure if it was Lafayette brand, an RF impedance meter. So off the top of my head, you know, I'm thinking like, well, what is this? This is just one of the many parameters you can do with a modern analyzer. But what I'm not sure, I guess in the application, would you check to see if your transmitter is at 50 ohms, which it's supposed to be, or your antenna is at 50 ohms, or whatever ohms it may be, whatever impedance it would be, that would be the purpose of this thing, because I didn't really get a chance to read anything about it. I just thought I'd ask you.
I haven't seen that particular object. It might be to test the antenna's impedance, or it might be used to check the impedance of, say, a transmission line, or an inductor and capacitor type of a situation. It probably would not be terribly effective for a transmitter, because transmitters aren't truly impedance matched. They're designed to operate efficiently with 50 ohms of impedance output. But that doesn't necessarily mean that if you point a device into a powered device like the final of a transmitter, it would read anything that made much sense as far as impedance is concerned.
That's something I never did try, and I was aware of that fact about if I connected that to a transmitter. But so it's a self-contained type of unit. I guess I would use that as an antiquated. Type of analyzer, more of an analog style analyzer. So it would have a 50 ohm impedance, I guess, wherever it was resonant. Is that how it would work, or would it show given antenna? Where it would show a different impedance at a different frequency? Of course, it's non-resonant. So I'm not sure how. What kind of information I would glean from that instrument? If the question's unfair, just let me know. But I know you're very good with antenna analyzers, so this is probably just one parameter from an ancient piece of equipment.
Yes. Well, I assume it would be somewhat useful to find resonance, or at least the lowest practical impedance in a frequency range. You have to have some external frequency sweeping it, and then you would check its impedances. Because resonance antennas, unfortunately, don't have the same impedances. It depends upon the design. A resonant half-wave end-set, it has an impedance of about somewhere between 2 and 3,000 ohms, whereas the resonance of a center-fed dipole is only 73 ohms. So resonance isn't always the same thing as a particular impedance.
I'll admit that I didn't even know that. So a lot to learn with the different styles of antennas and all these parameters. Very good. Obviously, you know you know the subject and you know how to use the analyzer. Me, I guess I just get lucky. My instincts are good. But all right, I might keep that instrument in mind anyway. I never used anything on any of my HF antennas yet. I really haven't. The grid dip meter, I did a quickie test on, but that's not the same. That's showing resonance, but not necessarily impedance. So, would I yield the same results? I guess. So basically, the grid dip meter showed that that I had resonance at, oh, let's just say 14 megahertz, that this impedance meter would allegedly be around 50 ohms at the same frequency. Is that how it would work? Or do I have that wrong?
Again, it depends upon the antenna design. If you had a center-fed dipole and your bridge dip meter showed a resonance of the antenna, then chances are the impedance that you'd get from that center-fed dipole would be something on the order of 50-odd ohms. If it was a Windom where it's off-center, as you move the feed point away from the center of a resonant dipole, its impedance increases even though it continues to be resonant. So the impedance shifts up, as I said, at the extreme end, where it's at basically an end-fed half-wave, it's 2,000-3,000 ohms. But throughout that entire episode of shifting the feed point, you get a change of impedance, but you don't get a change in the resonance because it's still total for half-wave, and your bridge dip meter should show you coupling as a resonance of that frequency. So the bridge dip meter will tell you if you're resonant without telling you what your impedance is, and the impedance meter will primarily tell you what your impedance is, but not definitively tell you that you're resonant at that impedance.
Okay. So that's a lot of instruments you got to use, and there's a few others, I'm sure, where with these modern antenna analyzers, you got it all on one screen. One instrument, very good. All right, maybe an additional appreciation for the modern analyzers.
You're able to get them at ridiculous prices these days. Recently, Rich W2BZ was interested in getting an antenna analyzer, and he didn't really want to spend the extra money, so he found a great deal. Rig Expert, that sells an entire line of portable vector network analyzer/antenna analyzers, sells a Beer circuit board. You can take that Beer circuit board, and it only costs about $60-70. It goes up to the high end of HF. It doesn't have any input-output, so you have to wire it to a USB converter, but you can get the cheap one for about $10-15, then give it a 5-volt power supply, plug it into a computer, run some software, and you have a serviceable BNA/antenna analyzer for under $100. And he's just starting to play with his.
Alrighty, Roy, very good. And glad I got to talk to you. Sorry I missed the rest of the net. And let me not hold you up. I'll let you get back to what you were doing, and I'll say goodnight to the ladies here, so thanks for picking me up, and until next time, take it light, Ray, N2HOH.
Okay, very good, Andy. Thank you very much for popping in to say hello. Once again, this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra with the post-TechNet game, I guess. I'll be back here in 2 weeks. We'll do it all over again. Until then, there's the 10-meter net, and there's, of course, the Limar Tech net, all kinds of fun nets out there. So go out there and have a lot of fun. That's the whole point of the exercise. So AC2GS here, going clear.